Welcome to the Glass Lab podcast, where we talk all things product development. It's our goal every month to introduce you to the people, ideas, and development tools that are shaping the hardware products we all use every day.
Welcome back to the Glass Labs podcast, everyone. I'm Grant Chapman, one of the co-founders and CEO here at Glassboard. I've actually got Sean Kleinschmidt, one of the partners here with us at Glassboard, finally on the podcast again.
Made it.
Yep. All right. And our guest today is Mike Kelly, CEO and co-founder of Developer Town and one of the co-founders of Start Something Ventures. Welcome to the podcast.
Thanks for having me.
Oh, it's been awesome to finally get you here. It's you're one of the few peers in our industry here in the city that are also a service provider, also kind of entwined throughout the industry. So super excited to get some of your inputs and kind of how you structure your different ventures, as they say, because you've got more than a handful. So my titles weren't quite all correct. There's more under that hood that we don't have to unpack right now.
Yeah.
But to get started, love to get a little bit of background for anyone listening that might not know who you are, of generally, where did you come from and how did you get here?
Grew up in northern Indiana in a small town. My claim to fame is I was one of the first houses that had two phone lines so that we could get dial-up going.
Fancy.
Wrote my first operating system when I was somewhere between 10 and 12. So fell in love with computers at a young age. Did some consulting work in high school, and then kind of knew I was going to go to school for computer science. Did that up in Fort Wayne, the big city where I was from, and went to college there, started a consulting company with a handful of friends. I was the worst programmer, which put me in charge of sales and finances and all that kind of stuff. Still get to work with a couple of those guys now. They're lovely humans, still smarter than me. And then after college, the band broke up. They all went and got real jobs, and I did independent consulting for a number of years. Still focused on building products and software, and did that for about 10 years. Relocated to Indianapolis somewhere along that journey to get access to a larger airport and to start an MBA program. And once I was done with the MBA program, got my first full-time gig. Initially at Liberty Mutual Insurance, which is also a great place for first-time managers. They invest a lot in first-time managers. So that was a great experience. And then after that, I took a leadership role at a startup here in town where I met my co-founder at Developer Town, Michael Korn, and another co-founder, Jason Vasquez, and another co-founder, Mitch Shields. So there were four of us there. And we worked together at Interactions for a couple of years. Then the band broke up, common theme. And when we all decided to start leaving there, Michael had the idea of a bunch of tiny houses on wheels and doing software development work for startups for a mix of cash and equity. And that's where Developer Town came from. And then I don't know if you want me to keep going on background, but I can kind of talk a little bit about that evolution over the next 10 years.
Does that make sense? No, I think that I'd love to kind of dive into, you said it started for, equity and cash. And
yeah.
I'd love to hear how that evolved. Where are we at with that relationship on products? Glassboard's played that game a bit and learned a lot of lessons along the way. And I think all the startup founders believe that every service firm pines for equity in their clients. In reality, it makes for us a really tough relationship later. It's great in the moment. Everyone's happy when it first, everyone's getting working together in the same product and feeling like rowing the boat in the same direction. And then the service firm model doesn't track with how the equity model tracks.
It was an awful business idea. And it was, I think it was an attempt at a studio model before studios were really a thing.
They're just now really becoming well known.
I mean, they were around earlier than now, but they weren't, they certainly didn't have the playbooks and the maturity that they have now. And so we did that for a couple of years. We really struggled for those first couple of years on a cash flow basis for obvious reasons. When you're taking half of your, probably not half, when you're taking a third of your compensation in equity, that doesn't leave the margin that you would typically have when a startup can't pay its bill.
Right.
And so just made payroll every 2 weeks really, really painful. And so we got tired of living that way. We said, we build great products. We can do that for startups and large companies alike. And so we started moving further and further upstream. After, I'd say, a couple more years of flirting with trying to find a way to make that work, we left it behind altogether and just said, we're just going to be a boring software consulting company. We'll work with companies who are happy to pay their bills. That actually is what lit our flywheel and gave us the momentum to then start spinning out other ventures and doing other investments. Today, we only work with larger companies, primarily healthcare financial services. We love helping them build and launch new products, just like a startup would, but we like doing it with bigger clients. And then on the side, in our side hustle time, we invest in startups through Start Something Ventures, and we're still pretty active in the indie venture community. We have a couple of our own companies that we still run that are more startup focused, but we really try hard to kind of not cross the streams and treat them all as separate businesses.
And is it mostly separate by size? You said most of Developer Town is larger clients that you're working with. And then is that really kind of how you separate those two entities, that they don't become intertwined?
They're all separate in every way. So separate companies, separate bank accounts, in a lot of cases now separate ownership. In the early days, that wasn't the case. Mm-hmm. So in the early days, every time we would spin out a new company, it would be basically a copy and paste of the Developer Town cap table.
An op agreement and all that stuff. Yeah. Just find and replace the company name.
Just find and replace, do it again. But, you know, there's a couple of things that break there over time. One, some of our ventures have raised outside capital, which is good. We're really big on employee equity in a lot of our companies. So now many of our venture companies have employees who are well compensated with equity in those companies. And
on that, I want to ask, that's not an employee and stock option program. This is not an ESOP. This is employees that become partners in the company. Yeah. And that's a very different line. That is a different way of doing that business that I've learned over the years is a very well-driven model. If you can manage it effectively, that, you know, giving people skin in the game in a company when it makes sense really tracks, but trying to do that in small slivers doesn't meet anyone's expectations, either how much effort an employee is going to give because they have skin in the game, or how much money that employee may make because they have skin in the game.
Right. Yeah. So those changes helped a lot along the way. And so now it's pretty divergent. When we talk affectionately about the Developer Town family of companies, there's a number of them, and we have partners across those companies, partners in air quotes, if you're just listening to this. And that's typically going to be, the CEO of that company, the senior leadership team, and then investors and folks like that. So when you go across a family of companies, you'll see a lot of very similar faces, but they're now not all the same across every company.
Right. And you've kind of got some more swim lanes within your organizations of some person's leading these kinds and some are leading these kinds and really having to diversify.
Yeah. And some companies only have folks who are very, very focused on that company and that they don't really worry about anything else.
Yep. No, for sure. It's one of those things that as these companies mature, they just need more attention. And you have to have someone dedicated that's their sole mission to drive that to the future.
Yes.
So I'd love to rewind a bit. And where was it in Developer Town that you realized the equity game wasn't working with your clients? And how did you guys come to that conclusion? Because I know at Glassboard, I can give you, just a primer for how we discovered it is. It was cash flow, like you were talking about, payroll problems, et cetera. But really, the thing for us is it made the motivations of everybody inaccurate, wrong, right? Our clients gave us equity in the moment and then expect us that was all the equity we're ever going to get. But we need to take some amount of value proposition, whether it's a dollar, a gold coin, or an equity, for every hour or month or week of service you bill, because that's how service models work.
Right.
That's how our employees work. Everyone's got to take them a paycheck. And that's the disconnect that you get, hey, here's your equity. It's, insert single digit percentage here. You're a team member. Great. That covered 6 months of bills. Awesome. We did that exchange. Everyone's happy, that investment, quote unquote. But when the next round came to raise and they were short on the round, we didn't get, another X percent for six more months of work. It was, you're already in. You need to do the next 6 months for free.
Yeah.
That happened to you a lot. Is that some of the reoccurring themes?
Yeah. So that and more. So I have a great blog post on this. I'll send you, maybe you can include it in the show notes, but, we saw two different classes of problems. One were the financial problems that you're talking about, where as a business model, if you say most consulting companies are trying to run somewhere between 20 and 40% profit margin, say 30%, and you're then trying to figure out how much you're going to invest on an equity basis into a company, if you're typically running a 30% profit margin and then you put all of that margin into equity, you now have no room for breakage or growth, by the way. So breakage is when a client can't pay their bill and now you got to find that money somewhere to make payroll because you have no profits, so to speak. They're all in equity. And then the other way that may manifest is you need to hire another developer. Well, in a professional services model, if I bring you in today, I have to pay you in 2 weeks, but I can't collect money on you in 2 weeks. First, I have to train you. I have to onboard you. Then I have to put you on a client site. It's going to be 30 days of you billing, and then they probably have net 30 on their terms. So my best case is it's 60 days if you are immediately productive the first day you show up, and more likely it's 90 days before I see a penny for the work that you have coming in.
Let alone a profit from the work. Like, right. This is like the actual, yep. I don't see a penny. There's nothing coming from the pipe. And it's always funny when I try to explain this to people of what the lag time is of hiring a new employee and getting them up to speed and when they really become profitable, let alone break even, right?
Yeah.
Or break even, let alone profitable.
So when you think of investing that cash flow into equity, which is what you're doing, mm-hmm. It's also stifling the growth of your company that might be on a growth trajectory. If you're assuming you're not steady state and you haven't been that size forever, if you have plans to grow your company, that is a real dollar you're taking out of your business and putting into somebody else's from a growth perspective. So you have all those financial incentives. Then you have the consulting incentives, which I would say the second I own equity in your business, it's now a different conversation. If I need to have a crucial conversation with you about your behavior, your performance, the way I need you to show up as a product owner, the way I need you to show up as a client, the way you treat my teammates, my employees. And it's very easy for me if I can just fire you and say, hey, right. Grant, you're a jerk. You can't do that to my employees. Go away. Sorry to pick that example.
It's a good one. If firing clients is something that most people don't think you have to learn how to do in a consultancy, and it is the only thing you have to learn that's not natural, because it's not natural to fire a money source, but it's really healthy for the business to get rid of the ones that aren't healthy for the business.
Right. But I can't do that once we have equity. Or I shouldn't say I can't.
Really,
it's much, much harder.
It's just very expensive.
Yeah. And the inverse is also true. The other thing that makes us good as a consulting firm is a client who is willing to give us feedback along the way and is willing to hold us accountable. And when we know that there's a competitive process and we have to win and we have to go the extra mile and we have to win your love and attention every day, like, that's going to make your consulting partner show up better. It's what makes your employees show up better, right? It's all of us. All of us need accountability.
And pressure turns coal into diamonds.
That's right. And so once we have equity, what we found is a number of those clients would stop having the crucial conversations with us from an accountability perspective that would then allow us to bring our best work. Or they would just make assumptions altogether that would, we were their only thing and we didn't have other projects and other clients. They'd treat us like maybe the way they would treat an employee, which maybe that was well-intentioned.
It's worse than an employee. It's always an employee who now has equity.
Yeah.
Which is a huge amount of responsibility versus an employee, right?
Sean,
speaking of our clients that face that in the pressure turns coal into diamonds, I think we got a couple of clients, especially in projects that you're on, where that feedback from the stakeholders earlier would have made the project way easier.
Yeah, absolutely.
Right. And it's one of those things, like, everyone thinks that, oh, my consultant's going to be angry at me if I tell them I think it's ugly or that it's wrong or all these things. And I'm like, we don't have any emotional attachment to our work in the moment. Now, if the product doesn't launch, we're all upset. But in the moment, man, let's knife fight, rip it to shreds. Let's turn this into the best version of what it can be. And I'll tell you, if we're going to go over hours, we're going to go over our resources we've allocated to a program. And there's, good, fast, cheap. You got three knobs. Pick two or hyper index on one. We can have a conversation of where should we be putting that effort, right?
Yeah. Yeah. So that's now the performance consulting side of it. And then there's a third pathology that emerged, which was internal politics. So now this might have been a consequent, well, certainly there was some consequence of this based on how we compensated our employees at the time. At the time that we did this, almost every employee was I'm going to use the word profit share. We had a different word internally, and I'll just leave that as insider baseball, but just call it profit sharing employee.
Yep.
So if you worked on a project that was an all cash client, you got paid in all cash. If you worked on a client that was an all equity client, you got paid in all equity. And if you worked on a client that was a mix of the two, which was obviously the most of them, you got paid in a mix of them.
So how did that employee get to work on a client, or were they assigned? Like how did that go? Because that's the most fascinating part of this for me.
Yeah. So so sometimes there was a small amount of optionality when that's allowed for, right? But most of it's a consulting company, so most of the time you're placed on a project. Now I say that this was it was a form of profit sharing. So you had a base salary.
Right.
You knew what you're going to make. This is
total comp.
From a total comp perspective, there was variability based on the type of work that you did. And again, this is the really, really early days of Developer Town. So that would then create perverse incentives where people might, let's say I have two clients I'm assigned to. one where I'm just getting paid cash and one where I'm just getting, where maybe I have more equity. Mm-hmm. Now, if I feel the equity value is worth a lot, which is subjective and can't be controlled, I might steal more of my time and attention on that one. And I might ignore the other one and maybe deliver fewer stories. Conversely, let's say I think the equity value is not worth a lot.
I don't trust the founder or the client or all the things, but I get paid in equity and insert, it's magic space dollars.
Insert all the things. Now suddenly I might spend more time on the cash paying client. And all of this is person by person, could be week by person, could
day by day, meeting by meeting.
You got it.
And that's tracked by hours, by stories. How do you even like
shoot that? We did it. In the early days we billed by story point. So that all would have been by story. But I don't actually think it was the way that we were billing was necessarily a problem. It was just that you had a different set of incentives as an employee based on the way the deal was structured.
Yep.
The other thing that we noticed, because we also worked on some of our own internal projects, were that you could also see perverse incentives around people advocating for their own project. People just ignoring billable work they were assigned to and focusing on side hustle stuff.
Such a mini companies all trying to figure out a direction together.
Right. And very much was Lord of the Flies. Yeah. So you take all three of those things. Now again, it's not like it was 2 years of that
chaos.
We did get smarter somewhat, you know, over time around some of those areas and put in better processes and controls. And we changed the comp structure and we did some smarter things. But at the end of the day, we couldn't solve the incentives around the client relationship. And what we found is we did our best work for customers who just showed up, paid us cash, mm-hmm. and held us accountable. We all want to do our best work, everybody. And so if you just simplify the structure and you say, look, we're going to do a fair market transaction that you know how to hold us accountable to and that we know how to deliver on, because it turns out we built a process that can do this again and again and again. We can now run that playbook and everybody can get outcomes that we are within a range of expectations that we all know. Outside of that, if we then think your idea is a good idea,
your special flower,
we can then write you a check and invest if that makes sense.
That's literally the pitch I give to all the clients that ask for, you know, will you do this for equity? I'm like, well, you can pitch me as an investor, like personally, I will write you a check. You can endorse the back of it to Glassboard. I'll go cash it. And that's a totally fine transaction.
Yep.
Which is entirely different than Glassboard taking equity in what you do, because the incentives are not aligned.
Yeah. Right? The other thing we would say is on the venture side, it's an awful, awful venture model to swap equity
for service.
And there's two big reasons for that. The biggest one is it's probably even an inverse selection bias, meaning you have a bias for the least likely companies to succeed. If you work under the assumption that the most likely to succeed startups are the startups that are not going to struggle to attract talent
and funding,
and that those are going to be the most likely to succeed, then that's not going to be the startup that shows up on my doorstep or your doorstep
looking
to work with us for equity. So you're actually doing investment transactions with companies that are probably the least likely to succeed out of the entire pool of companies available in a given marketplace.
That's a phenomenal stats pick from the sky that makes total sense.
Yeah. So if you then step back and say, look, as an investor, if I'm just angel investor, mm-hmm. Grant Chapman, or if I'm Start Something Ventures, if instead I'm just going to run a process and I'm looking at every deal available to me in the marketplace, and yet this one who also might want equity for services came in at the top based on my objective criteria that doesn't, you know, that ignores that.
And other people I respect are also investing. Yeah, again, right. No one invests alone.
Yeah, right? That's right.
There's very few angels that are the first guy in the door, first money in when no one else cashes a check. Yeah. Very few of those. And there's a huge amount of angel pool that are, hey, if we can close a round of X, what do we call it, 250, 500K, get enough capital, A, to do something reasonable with the money or, you know, with it as an outcome. And two, more than one human also ran due diligence and interviewed this team and this founder and think it's a good idea.
Yep.
We're less likely to be wrong. Now, there's collective bias problems where if too many people are involved, that yes, everyone thinks it's a good idea and no one actually checked. But if you run your own process and other humans are also investing, you're starting to select for the other end of the pool, which is the successful, going to be successful with or without me. And that's why I should join the team.
That's right.
Right.
Yeah. You, this is the, who's the investor?
I could just start naming random names.
Go for it. It'll probably be in the top
Peter
three.
Thiel.
Nope.
Sean, you want to just go into this? I mean, the Warren Buffett.
Who did the startup podcast? Alex. Gimlet Media startup.
Seriously.
Yeah.
He had an investor on early.
Goldman?
But he had an investor on early on that, anyway, never mind. He'd strike this. So I'm just not going to come up with it. It doesn't matter. I'll come up with it in 15 minutes. But this investor basically said, I used to pick companies that I could make a personal impact in. So I wanted to make the investment because I could leverage my network. I could leverage my past experience. I could leverage all these things. And
this is the Shark Tank of like why you would want X person on that team to invest because they have the retail connection or vice versa.
And what I found as an angel investor is when I did those deals, they were very likely to fail. And it wasn't until I stepped back and I said, and I changed my mindset and I said, I'm only going to write checks into companies where they're going to be successful in spite of my help. Mm-hmm. So even if I introduce them to the wrong people, they're going to be successful. Even if I give them the wrong network of customers, they're going to be successful because they'll fire all those customers. Even no matter what I do, they're going to be resilient enough to not deal with me. You know, that's when I became successful as an angel investor, and that's why you know who I am, right? So that's the quote that investor said on the startup podcast that I thought was really, really powerful. And that's the same thing here, right? So if this company can be successful in spite of your help as a service provider, then maybe it's a good investment. But you obviously don't know that at that stage if they're just coming and you're starting a conversation and you're trying to figure this out and you're still dating and, it's all those things. So that's a investment thesis problem number one. And then investment thesis problem number two is service dollars are not recognized in the fair market, just like a dollar is.
They're not.
And so we had a couple of episodes in those early startups where we had done, I'll just make up a number here, $100,000 worth of services work. Mm-hmm. And that would have been based on the margin that we would have taken, right? So again, simple math, made up numbers. Let's say we charged $100 an hour and we were running at a 30% margin. The way that we would have done a deal in that first year is we would have said, hey, pay us $70 an hour in cash, $30 an hour in equity. And all of that upside, that $30, let it ride. Later in a couple of those deals, those startups then went to raise institutional rounds. And those later investors came back and said, yeah, we'd love to invest, but you have to get DeveloperTown to cut their equity
in half
piece. In half is a great number. Yeah. Like we don't believe they actually put in $100,000 because it has margin on it. So that $100,000 was really only 50 grand.
And it wasn't cash.
It wasn't cash. It was just time. And so now you're left in a place as a service provider. You can fight for what you think is right.
But you're going to drag the startup down.
That's right.
And you are going to be the anchor.
Yeah. You're the crab pulling the next crab down out of the bucket. right? Like that's exactly what's happening. Or you can shut your mouth, go along to get along and be like, yep, cut it in half.
You want a piece of a pie that goes to market, no matter how small that piece is.
Yep.
Because a pie that rots on the shelf for everybody.
But if you just written a check, nobody can ever, you can show a check stub. Nobody would ever know.
Check as long as it's from a different company. If it's from the same LLC, they ask questions. But as long as it's a different LLC, no one bats an eye.
Yeah. So we learned the hard way all the things to do wrong.
Thank you for the rest of us.
It was really great. I mean, we did learn a lot. We did learn something. So then in 2014, 2016, my co-founder, Michael Klorn, I don't talk about myself in the third person much. Michael did start a proper venture studio. We called it DeveloperTown Starts. We put together a small fund of our money, and then a couple of outside angels came in that fund, and we ran a studio model for 4 years, 2016 to 2020. We stopped during COVID, and we co-founded 10 companies going through that process, built an amazing team. Many of those folks we still have the pleasure of working with, and that portfolio did shockingly better than our first go at a broken studio portfolio. We still weren't in love on the other side of that. We still weren't in love with the studio model for a couple of reasons. One, it's very, very hard to do that much context switching.
It's a lot of clutch.
Yeah.
And the emotional side of the studio model, I think, is tough for most people. The accelerator model makes a ton of sense. Like, I'm going to take a really small piece of equity just to give you a boost, and I've got a network, and you're buying to plug in. That's the accelerator model. It all tracks. The studio model, because I was an EIR in a studio on the East Coast for a battery startup, so I've been the EIR. Some of my clients today are studios that use my services to help a vet due diligence or do develop and bring it out of wherever they're picking the tech up from. And it's a super tough thing because who does the buck stop with and who owns this as a product owner has always been tough. Because it's often that it's no longer the original founder that is really the product owner. So there's no, you know, piss and vinegar or, you know, eating cheese sandwiches and sleeping in a cot under your desk. This is like, oh no, I got to get paid to do this. And when the first fund doesn't close around, those things just evaporate. And most companies don't close their first round like, you know, book closes. It's a rolling, tough,
right.
Throwing, through, you know, walking through the valley of fire and flames and on broken glass.
Yeah. It could be a fun podcast to get Michael and Connor on here to share more of their stories.
Absolutely.
Going through that process, because they were the ones who lived that, not me. While they were doing that, I was figuring out how to scale DeveloperTown to work with bigger and bigger companies. So, but it was a lot of fun. And we do have, again, we have some great team members who've come out of that, great partners. Also, we do have some lovely companies that have come out of that process, which we're really excited about, remain really excited about. But in 2020, we decided not, partly because of COVID, partly because I think the team was a little burnout on that many companies. We said, let's not do another studio. Let's double down our resources on a couple of those companies that had come out and had really, really shown promise. Mm-hmm. And so the team chose to do that. And then on the venture side to scratch that itch, that's when Michael and I started Start Something Ventures.
Yeah, well, I think that you just highlighted the reason why I think studios get tough. They're not tough to start. They're actually super fun to start. Because basically what you do is you go raise money just like a fund.
Yeah.
But you get to go run all the startups with you and your team. And it's great until some of them take off. And they need real attention, 24 hours a day, you know, like real grow company size. And what you have to do is you not only have to have a funnel of companies to put into the studio model, right? Just like a VC,
you have to have
a huge filter. You have to have an EIR or founder or talent pipeline just as big. That's tough. That's the one that I think most of the studios, the ones at least on the East Coast that I was working with, had trouble with, that their founder talent was way in, you know, in a different offset than their like actual technical talent that they were, you know, companies they were trying to bring in. And that was the mismatch. So super great thing is, well, if you can get the accounting and finance and legal and all the other great things a studio supercharges for these startups, you can get that processed out and then get them connected to venture through the studio or that connections. It supercharges getting technology and companies off the ground. But you really have to make sure you found the founders to go run them, because if they're going to a studio, it's not the original founders, right, that are running them traditionally. Most of the time, those guys are going for an accelerator and fully sending it.
I will say that that's one of the things that our team tried that was a little unique in the world of studios that I do think was beneficial and helpful, is that we call it co-founding companies, not founding, because I'm going to butcher this because, again, I wasn't in it every day like those guys were, but I want to say 2/3 of the companies were already existing companies at some stage of their journey, and they came in. So some of them had revenue, in some cases significant revenue. Some of them were, you know, kind of had a product, but hadn't really found product market fit. And then some of them were idea stage. So
this is interesting.
So we had all three.
How did you convince the founders to do the like big split that it takes to do the studio model financially well? Or did we not take enough equity in the studio? And that is a lesson we learned.
Honestly, I don't know. I'd want Michael here to answer that. Cause again, this is his 10,000 hours, not mine, but I'll tell you from my armchair quarterback position, some of the things that I saw. One, we did not take egregious amounts of equity from anybody.
Got it. So you didn't do the traditional studio model, which is, this is now ours.
Yeah.
And you're here for the ride.
Right. Yeah. Okay. So our equity stakes this is not perfect. So forgive me, team, if I get some of this wrong, but say it would have been anywhere from like 10% to 40%.
Oh, interesting.
Kind of a range. Like there's no studio company where we came in and we're like, we own 70% of your company and you're now working for us. Like, that's dumb.
Oh,
we didn't do that.
So every studio I've ever worked with is much closer to that.
Yeah.
Like the one in the East Coast, I think the founders, we all split 20%. Like the scientist that actually like discovered the idea, we were working on the battery space. And then I, who was the EIR CEO that had to run the thing, we split 20%.
And
that was all we had.
Yeah. I think there's a couple of things there from a values perspective. One, we think that creates a future problem for getting real executive leadership, just like you said, right? This is the problem every studio has. And so we were nervous about that too. Again, we wanted to run the experiment of stepping into companies that were already down the path.
And that had to be super fun.
In some ways.
How are you finding these companies?
Great challenges and others. We have a great network here in town. You know, both Michael had a great network before DeveloperTown. I had a pretty good network. We got known pretty well or pretty quickly in the startup community through PowderKeg and others. And so, you know, we had a reasonable large pool to draw on from conversations and talent and stuff like that. And so, you know, we worked a lot of those networks. We didn't deploy. I mean, so we worked with 10 companies over a 4-year period. We tried to do that in cohorts. So we did cohort one, which thinking about it as 5 companies. Cohort two was 2 years later, I think, which was another 5 companies. So there was some spacing there. So we had time to get deal flow to go. And it's not like we said, okay, cohort one, like an accelerator would. We didn't say, okay, all 5 of your companies are starting now.
May 1st.
Right.
Here we go. This is the date. It's 12 weeks.
Yeah. Let's go. So we needed a company to get the first deal going. And then then there was some pressure to deploy to get the next companies in, right? Because you want to get the cohort going. But it's not like we had a charter that said we have to have all 5 companies going by July 2nd, right? Like it wasn't that. So the team did a reasonably good job, I think, looking at the portfolio today of taking appropriate risks. Some of those were, let's go for it. Let's try to hit some home runs. Winner take all products. Some of those were, hey, this could be a nice single or a double. Like this is a nice business that we'd be really, really happy to be a part of for years to come. And maybe there's a pivot in the future that makes it really, really big. But, you know, what we see right now is a good enough market from a B2B SaaS perspective. Like, let's go do it.
And it's risk reward, right? You have to build the spread. Like just going betting, doing any sports betting or Vegas betting, you only make actual money out if you bet the spread because nothing happens in a point load. And those guys that win point loads are just lucky. They weren't good. It's you have to have many little bets in the high risk and the low risk and the medium risk to make it whole for everybody. Yeah. Right? Otherwise, you're not going to win in the startup or venture game, right?
Yeah.
I think that's the thing I tell everyone. Like most companies fail miserably, right? What is it? 1 in 10 make it as the general stat or what? I don't even know where that came from or if it's real, but feels that way. So, you know, you need a lot of little bets to make sure that one of them can grow big and strong and make it to market.
Yeah. So we learned a lot through that process as well. And then our most recent go at this, last year we co-founded another software development company called Boundless, with Jason and Caleb, 2 amazing humans who have been working together for years and, wanted to take a run at this with us. And this is our kind of 3rd attempt into something approaching a studio. Where with the Boundless team, what we're trying to do is partner with a number of venture groups here in the central Indiana market to basically say, do these groups want to share the risk of basically launching a studio tech company along with Boundless? So Boundless would be the service provider, but the investors would come along at stage points, predefined stage gates along the way and fund that development work. As it's moving through the process, we have not done a deal like this is all on paper today, but we're excited in that we think it solves a couple of the problems of kind of that service provider venture relationship.
Yep.
And also we're hopeful that because it's a group of different venture folks coming together to do this, who all come with our own biases for what's a good market and how to vet a deal and how to vet a founder and how to vet a, you know, we're actually also a little optimistic that this could lead to better deal selection from the get-go and that there'll be a lot of opinions, which going back to what you said earlier about the early discovery process, opinions are good at that stage.
Yes, they are.
Because that friction, we believe, might lead to better investment outcomes. So, we're excited to try to do our first 1 or 2 deals next year. Jason, Michael, and I have been working on some of that very recently, and we have a number of partners on the venture side that are excited to run that experiment with us.
Oh, that's awesome. I this is the first I've heard about this, so I'm super jazzed to hear that's cooking.
We're breaking news. Yeah.
Awesome. Oh, that's super cool. And when you say certified, so you're looking for the Boundless team to do the like tech stack, actually like SaaS development.
Yep. They'll do the tech development.
Awesome. And then how are you making the studio model work from the founder side of that? Or are you looking for companies that have the founder side and actually need
the
tech side? So you're doing even different than what I'd call a traditional studio where you're actually doing like service provider studio.
Yeah. This would be a founder comes in with, I'll paint my picture of a perfect founder who who knows, right? But in my mind, a perfect founder is going to be, obviously, this will be their third company, clearly, because they're the perfect founder.
They had one win and one loss.
Yeah, yeah, exactly. repeat founder, deep, deep industry expertise in the area that they're building a product. Maybe have one or two other key players from a team perspective already kind of sighted in on, and maybe they're not full, those other folks aren't full time yet, but they're lined up and ready to go, and open to coaching, and is very opinionated and on their product but not the technology, which we love opinionated products. We don't love people who are opinionated about technology, because technology just changes so much so quickly, so you just can't be. They would pitch the idea. So stage gate number one, right? They're going to pitch the idea just like you would pitch pre-product, pre-revenue. Think of a pitch competition, yep, right?
This is your 10-slide pitch deck. This is my dream. This is my market. Yep. This is why we're going to do it.
Yep. This is the pitch deck version. They would, assuming they get past that stage gate, we would then do our first round of funding, which would give them enough to basically go get a clickable prototype,
get
your Figma, go out to the market, start to get customer feedback. Maybe congruent with this, they might do something like GrowthX Revenue Accelerator. GrowthX may not want people with Figma in their accelerator. I don't know. We have to have that conversation. But there's this idea that they have a partner who's now also not just helping them on product development, but customer development, getting feedback from the market, things like that. And GrowthX team does an amazing job with that. Then they come back. And now they're going for that next tranche of money, which is, hey, look, here's the feedback we got. Here's what customers are saying. Here's what contracts might look like. Maybe I have a couple letters of intent. Maybe I have a couple, whatever, right? Whatever traction looked like.
You're the people that think we're cool.
Yep.
Right. Here's the list. Please grade me. Did I do good? Did I do bad?
And then we go into a build phase. And then from there, I should stop saying tech, because you guys are also tech. Software products, very different than your world. And that, within a matter of weeks, we can have something up and running and have customers logging in and starting to do solve real things, right? And I know there are probably fidget spinners and things where you guys can do that, but that's not the world you typically live in.
It's so funny how you guys literally can do 0 to 95% in the blink of an eye.
Yeah.
But it is the last 5% to make it real and stable and great that is just painful and expensive and all things that, tech is.
Yeah.
And in hard tech, we're the other way around. That, man, you got to take the 55-gallon drum of kerosene, put all the dollar bills in that and light it up just to get to something that customers can really use. Even the prototypes that we build at Glassboard, one of the things we pride ourselves most on is getting early prototypes to users, right? Finding creative prototyping processes, especially for medical device, because our hands are tied.
Yeah.
We can't just use anything that comes off any 3D printer, but we've had to develop some processes to get really early prototypes in or inside users. And that's been the challenging part in the hardware space. And we've been able to do that because you're correct. It's so important to get your MVP, minimum viable prototype, not minimum viable product, in the hands of a user to get feedback so you can iterate early. Big pivots early, super cheap. Big pivots at the nth hour, really expensive. So trying to drive that home for us is, again, we fight a more uphill battle to do that. But it's one of the things that we pride ourselves most on at Glassboard is to very heavy ahead that prototyping stage early and often get that feedback. Because for us, once we do DFM and get into manufacturing, and if we did anything wrong, that's now a recall. That's really bad for you guys. Software updates are constant and needed thing for security or features or updates. And it's a totally different world where we're all front loaded and you guys are almost all rear loaded, where the effort and the real heavy lift and expertise needs to come in.
Well, this is the thing we always tell our customers. If you're building a SaaS product today in particular, you're never done.
Right.
You're never done. You're engineering forever. So it's not how much is this product going to build cost me. It's how much am I going to spend every month until the end of time?
Well, and the answer becomes, what percent of revenue do I need to spend on engineering to maintain viability, next tranche, growth, next tranche, happiness, customers, go viral, all those things, right? There's three tiers in software that really make it stable, likable, and then really, really it, right? That final 2 or 1% of polish that makes it the it version of whatever software it is the hardest thing to pull off. And ironically, that ties into one of our friends, Mike Reynolds at InnovateMap. I think one of the things that people overlook in the tech stack, quote unquote, of both software and hardware is UX UI and how much that can really push a great piece of software, a good piece of software into great. Or same with hardware for us, or user experience, the user interface can make a really good tool great.
Yeah.
And that's just a segue into another episode we've recorded in the past with another Mike. But as we're
all the best ideas come from Mike's,
right? Yeah. No, I just need to go adopt one. I love that Drew and I's middle names are both Michael, so I think we can at least half
real?
Right. Yeah.
Oh, nice. Yep. You're half right.
Yeah, exactly. It takes two of us to make one of you. We know where the inferiority scale lives. But no, seriously, thank you so much for sharing that whole journey from developer town to the studio to Start Something Ventures, which is something that, you know, I'm trying to get involved with Start Something. I think you guys are doing a really good job in your angel network to get that optionality in for both the startups and the investors of this is the marketplace, let's go play. And I think that's such a cool way to play. But seriously, thank you for sharing and coming on.
Yeah, really enjoyed being here. Thanks awesome. So much.
We'll catch you all next time. Take care. Thank you.